Save big on everything for your next staining project when you shop at Menards. Transform your home in one weekend with exterior stain and sealer from Dutch Boy. It provides one coat protection on decks, fences, siding, and outdoor furniture, and repels rain after just 4 hours of application. That means quicker results, saving you both time and money. Check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Menards. Coming up on this week's show, the Atari ST turns 40.
Organize your Game Boy pictures.
We go inside the world of Chronicles of Riddick with Coz Lazarus.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday thanks to our wonderful sponsor, Bitmap Books. Now, one of their books actually has just landed. Have you heard of Hurt Me Plenty, The Ultimate Guide to First-Person Shooters, 2003 to 2010? Now, this is the follow-up to their massive book, I'm Too Young to Die, and celebrates the blockbuster era of the FPS with more than 220 PC, console, handheld, and arcade games listed in here, and weighing in at a massive 464 pages, and of course printed to their usual incredible standards. If you love your FPS games, definitely check it out, and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 483, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood,
me, Ravi Abbott,
and me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to the show, the podcast that comes out every single Friday and, of course, brings you up to speed on all the goings-on in the wonderful world of retro gaming and technology from over the last week, and brings you veterans of the industry onto the podcast each week for a bit of a chat about their career and the incredible games that they worked on. We have got an amazing guest on the way this week. Obviously, now we are into June. High summer here in the UK. I know you've been doing a bit of a late spring cleaning, Ravi, clearing out all your old monitors and everything before you were... You bought even more.
Yeah, it's just like broken stuff. And then as soon as you want to try and get rid of retro systems, then someone's like, oh, you're into old computers, aren't you? And you're suddenly inundated with even more. So, yeah, I think I'm just going to give up.
Yeah, some people might have seen the picture on our Facebook page of you down at the dump with all those old CRTs piled high. And God, I was so desperate just to drive.
But before everybody goes crazy, they weren't my CRTs.
No,
I was taking photos of CRTs in that horrific storage room that people put all their monitors in a place to die, and it's just like you want to dive in and grab everything, but the council people will be like, no, get him.
Heartbreaking. Yeah, that is that caused a bit of reaction on our Facebook during the week as well. So if you haven't joined us on the socials, definitely worth jumping on there. It was a bit of a giggle. Now, this week, I didn't mention we have got another incredible guest. We're going to be going inside the world of some really interesting companies with our guest this week, Coz Lazarus. Now, his career, he's worked in the industry for 33 years, and he's got a really interesting story. Joe and I did this. He actually kind of fell into the industry by accident when he turned up for an interview at a games company, Bit Studios, instead of his friend.
Yeah, really, really interesting story. Obviously, you know, all the incredible games he's worked on over the years and huge companies he's worked for. But from a storytelling point of view, really, really interesting life. And if you're into comics as well, the start of his story is really, really interesting. But ended up working with some, I won't spoil it, but some really big names, some famous people, some people who are really big into their family, is all I will say, in terms of how famous some of these people are he's worked with over the years. But yeah, really, really, really big career over the last 33 years.
Interesting, because you guys did this interview and you just told me, you know, there's a lot of mention of 2000 AD in there. So it's one that I'm really looking forward to listening to.
Yeah, he went from wanting to work in comics to then, basically complete, you know, handbrake turn into the games industry. Got to work on some huge comic franchises throughout his career as well. One story that we got that I thought was quite interesting was the first big game that he was kind of the solo manager of was Last Action Hero.
Yeah.
For the Super Nintendo and the Game Gear, which is, it always makes a list of those infamously bad titles, doesn't it, that game?
Yeah, which he did acknowledge as well, you know, and sometimes we don't want to go like, oh, that was a bad game or whatever kind of thing, but it tells you, you know, he explains what the story is there and the restrictions that got put in place and, you know, kind of what happened during the development of the game and stuff like that. And it's sometimes it's really nice just to hear the other side of the story as well.
Yeah, he had a full story about kind of what went wrong and what he learned from that. Then he worked on Itchy and Scratchy, you know, the Simpsons spin-off as well. He also worked on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Got to work on the TV show a bit as well. And then, of course...
Oh, my God. I would have loved that interview.
Oh, yeah. He designed some of the monsters. Yeah, yeah, exactly, on the TV series. And then, obviously, working at Tigan Studios with Vin Diesel founded that company.
Oh,
and
there you go. There's a spoiler.
Yeah, I think when we mentioned Chronicles of Riddick, everyone knows that Vin Diesel's involved. And then, last kind of half of the interview, we talk about obviously the Chronicles of Riddick games, you know, incredible FPS games back in the day. And yeah, it's a really interesting story there too. And then we talk about his current company that he's at, which is he's the co-CEO of a company called Ancient Machine. And they're working on a new point and click adventure game that's set in the alternate 80s in Miami called Vice Undercover. And I'll put the link to the Steam page because it's coming out very soon in about 2 months. And you can wishlist it, but also there's a playable demo on there as well. But yeah, this looks awesome, doesn't it? I love the concept of this as well. If you're into like games where you've really got to solve a lot of kind of mystery.
Yeah, yeah, it looks awesome. I love the 80s, you know, Miami Vice kind of style of it, yeah. But also... You know, it's very, I don't want to say murder mystery from what you described, but it's like, I love these games where it's like, this is what the future was in the 80s. You know, look at all these apps and stuff we can use. And, you know, and there's like references to Amiga in there and stuff, which is really cool as well.
Yeah, it's a bit like if you played the indie game Papers, Please. That's kind of one of the big inspiration on this game. So hopefully going to be another massive indie hit this summer on that retro 80s aesthetic as well. You know, I've always loved narrative-driven adventure game, so really hyped for this. So we got the story of all of that, an incredible career that he's had so far, and his new game as well, Vice Undercover, with this week's special guest, Coz Lazarus. He's on the show in around half an hour from now, but of course, if you're a regular listener, first half of the podcast is when we have a bit of a chat about what's been going down in the world of retro from over the last week. And actually, kind of ties in quite nicely, talking about point-and-click adventures. Turns out the Mega Drive is getting a new one, and this time kind of inspired a bit by the SNES game Clock Tower. Now, am I right in thinking, are you a fan of Clock Tower, Joe? I remember talking about that game before.
Yeah, you know, so I'm a fan of the idea of Clock Tower. I've never actually played them, but I've watched playthroughs of them. I even have the Clock Tower remaster that came out earlier this year from Limited Run Games, still sealed on the shelf, ready to go. Really, really want to play them. A series that I want to get into. It's an expensive series to get into if you get the, you know, the physical games. But yeah, horror point and click kind of adventure games. The only way I can kind of describe them is they play in real time as well. So like there's triggered events, timed events in the game, which will happen whether you're in the room or not, if that makes sense. Like, and this is what Bagman, which is the game we're talking about now, does as well. So this looks really interesting. So at the moment, there is only a few kind of like proof of concept demos and, you know, very, very early kind of like beta videos and some images and stuff like that. But it is apparently going to come out on Steam as well as the Mega Drive and Genesis and will run, you know, on Mega Drive Genesis, which I think is really interesting. It's being developed by an indie developer called Bad Tasty, you know, who says this game's not going to be out for a while. And I imagine it'll probably become a Kickstarter or something, you know, crowdfunding, yes. Which I really want to get behind because I think this looks really cool. And games that tend to go physical on the Mega Drive Genesis tend to just shoot up in price, you know, after they've come out on the aftermarket and stuff.
That's when you think, oh, I wish I'd bagged that.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, it looks really cool. It's you play a babysitter, you know, very classic 80s, 90s, and she's in a mansion, I believe, and there is a murderer called the Bagman, who looks terrifying, to be honest, from the concept art, wearing kind of like...
It's like a... Well, it's a bag made out of parts
human skin.
Of bodies. Yeah. And human skin, yeah. And yeah, it does look like, Bad Tasty, you know, the movie Bad Taste as well.
Yes! And yeah, it does actually a little bit.
It's got that kind of vibe. They're a studio from Manchester.
Oh, are they?
Interestingly. Yeah, yeah. And I think... It looks like quite a good game, but also pretty more gross than it looks because there's a whole load of death animations at the end. So there's multiple ways that people can get killed and stuff. So they seem to be in that like Hammer horror kind of gross freak out stuff. And that's quite cool because, Mortal Kombat, of course, you had all the multiple death endings and stuff like that.
Cool to see in a point and click adventure.
yeah, definitely. Well, apparently what's going to be unique about it is you're going to kind of have like a party of people you can command, and, you know, you can't control them, but you'll get them to do stuff in the other rooms, I guess, for puzzles, etc. But then obviously because it has timed triggered events, as Ravi's just said, I'm assuming these people can get killed in various different brutal ways when they're in other rooms leave them.
Yeah, it says like there's multiple endings, and the choices you make and the paths you walk down and the friends who get torn apart.
Nice.
yeah. It should be a lot of play, though, if you've got different endings and, you know, different choices.
Yeah, sure. So that it's available to wishlist on Steam now. No release date as yet, as you mentioned, Joe. It looks quite early in development. So I was kind of thinking it'd be awesome if this was out in time for Halloween this year, but, you know, might take a bit longer than that by the looks of the current state of the game. But I think the screenshots and the very short previews that we've seen so far, I mean, I love the fact they're bringing it out on the Mega Drive as well. And I'll link an article in from Time Extension in the show notes, and a few of the screenshots in there. There's some from Steam and a few from the Mega Drive version as well. So, yeah, graphically looks really nice. So you want to check that out. One to keep an eye on if you like your point-and-clicks and your survival horrors. Now, this is very cool. It's funny because hanging up actually opposite me right now, I've got my wife's Game Boy Pocket that she found in her old bedroom at her parents' house a few years ago. She said to me, "Oh, you can have this if you want." Complete with the camera accessory on there. We did actually look at it a while ago, and there's pictures of her and her sister from when they were kids on it still. She's like, "Oh my God, delete them, they're hideous." But if you have, maybe you've still got an old Game Boy with camera around, and you want to keep those pictures, because, I mean, even though they are low grain and often a little bit cringy, they're a part of history, aren't they? I said to you, you should always keep those pictures. Well, now it turns out there is actually a way to organise your Game Boy photos.
Yeah, this is interesting. So this is a kind of thing that could be done before, but it's in a complete browser-based package. So there was one called Epilogue Operator before, where you could kind of, you know, save data. You could also transfer your images off the Game Boy onto your machine and, like, organize them as well. This Game Boy Camera Manager is an actual site that you can go to. A lot like the Minidisc one, WebMD, that we talked about. You know, there's a lot of these tools now that you can just run in a browser. It's pretty amazing. And connect up your machine. So you'd connect your Game Boy or kind of Game Boy cart reader. I'm not sure how that side of it would work. But you load the files into the site, and then you have a series of options as well. So you can extract photos, you can convert them to PNG as well on the fly. You can edit the game faces in the mini games. So there was like mini games there, printable frames as well, and you can edit wild frames. There's like lots of different options with the actual ROM and the data, which is saved within the SRAM, which is the kind of photo data. So it does seem to be a good little organizer for it.
Did you have a Game Boy Color back in the day, Joe? And a camera for it?
Never had the camera since either. I had a Game Boy Pocket, the clear one. And then I got a Game Boy Advance a few years later. But no, never had the camera. I'm told am I right in thinking it was like the first ever digital camera? Or it was the first kind of like commercially accessible digital camera, technically?
Yeah, maybe affordable consumer one.
Yeah.
I don't know. There were a lot of digital cameras around, weren't they? But
yeah, expensive.
Yeah, I think maybe the first on a console or a handheld or something weird like that.
Maybe the first selfie camera. Yeah, wouldn't surprise me. I mean, yeah, the Game Boy was in selfies 25 years ago. Yeah, I think it's cool. I mean, like I said, you know, finding my wife's one, there's only about four or five pictures on there, but it is sad if they've been on there that long and they die with the device. It is good that you've got a way to back those up. So yeah, I think it's very worthwhile. I mean, obviously there's definitely a unique look to them, isn't there? I mean, the, you know, today we take for granted having super high resolution pictures taken by a really nice camera that's in our pocket all the time. But I think there is something quite charming about that kind of really low resolution, you know, no color on it, monochrome pictures that were taken on Game Boy cameras back in the day. So I think it is something worth preserving.
Yeah, you should preserve them now. You should transfer them onto this from your wife's Game Boy.
I think the fact that you can actually you know, use it again is good. Just free in a browser. That's what really appeals to me. Like bringing back these old technologies and, you know, reconnecting them and stuff, like the people that were doing the Game Boy Link as well and turning that into an online service. Stuff like that's really cool.
No, you make a good point as well, Joe. I think, you know, since she saw the pictures, oh my God, they're so cringy, delete them. But now I can link them to my Mac, I can upload them and put them on Facebook.
Absolutely.
For everyone to see. Yeah.
Print them out on the wall.
She should appreciate that.
When she comes home.
So if you want to check that out, it's on GitHub. So completely free, open source. And like you said, all web-based as well. So very cool. Get those Game Boy pictures backed up while you can. Now, this might be a surprising story for us to cover from some people, Ravi. But today we're celebrating the Atari ST, as this article that I'll link in the show notes mentions, everybody's second favourite 16-bit home computer. The reason we're talking about the ST is, of course, this week, the humble Atari ST turns 40 years old. First released, start of June in 1985. Now, we do make fun of it because, obviously, everyone knows us guys are Amiga fans, and the kind of Amiga ST rivalry goes back to the earliest days. But actually, we do forget that the Atari ST was actually a much bigger seller than the Amiga when it first came out.
I think it was cool. I don't think I've taken the mick out of the ST that much on this podcast.
Oh, I'm sure you've
probably
said some really, I'm
pull
sure
a load of clips out of me dissing the ST. But I think it's a beautiful machine. Like, the keys were absolutely fantastic on it. And some of the games, I remember, I think it was there was a Star Wars one on there. It was really good fun. I used to go around, and I only had one friend with an ST, and I'd go around and play on that. But stuff like Cubase as well, you can't beat it, can you? You know, that was a professional studio there with some great software. I know there's this constant argument about the audio capabilities and the Amiga being superior and all this, but the software also behind the audio, with stuff like MIDI, you know, having Cubase, which is just such a huge piece of software, was really important.
Obviously, the Amiga came along and kind of did overshadow it here in the UK by the early 90s. But I think you've got to, you know, you look at the context of 1985 when the ST came along. I mean, you know, it wasn't rivaling the Amiga then. It was replacing the 8-bit machines. So you think of, you know, the ST coming along. It had a really powerful processor for the price. You know, Motorola 68K in there.
Very nice monitors as well.
Yeah, well, yeah, that gorgeous monochrome mode that was really good for desktop publishing.
And you've got to put it into white ones. Yeah.
When you talk about what it was up against, really, I mean, you compare it to the price of like a Mac. The original Macintosh was way more expensive. And even the ST was often nicknamed the Jackintosh, wasn't it? Because it was like kind of Jack Tramiel's version of the Mac. A really powerful home computer, which was actually within realistic price range for normal people to buy.
Yeah, and it had a disk drive as well. You know, we forget a lot of people were using tape before.
Yeah, and into the early 90s, still a lot of home computer users are still using cassette tape.
Yeah, and that was quite a huge thing to have a floppy disk drive.
Yeah, and had the Gem desktop on there as well, that version of it, TOS, which we may have sniggered at that name a bit in the school playground. But based on Digital Research's Gem operating system, which, you know, very... If you've got an ST, which I have, it is great turning that on, it booting from ROM straight into the desktop, and, you know, just feel nice and snappy as well. You mentioned that high resolution monochrome mode, 640x400, beautiful, great for word processing, DTP, MIDI software as well, the built-in MIDI ports, which really, you know, the ST became the computer that musicians used in the 80s, 90s.
I think, you know, this war between ST and Amiga for so long has kind of pushed it into an area where you can't mention it without mentioning the Amiga. Yeah. And then, but, you know, it was first, it was before the Amiga 500. So it's really does stand on its own. I think it's a great little system, and we should stop comparing them and doing back and forth. The battles are over. You know, you can love your ST and you can love your Amiga.
And that's the thing. I mean, if maybe you've never given the ST any attention, it's interesting because I did a video about it. God, probably going back over a decade now. On my YouTube channel, where I looked at it from the perspective of someone who wasn't all that familiar with the platform and looking at it through fresh eyes. And, you know, there is a great demo scene on the ST as well.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the Uni and the Lost Boys.
There's some good PD games as well.
Yeah. One great thing about it was he used MS-DOS compatible floppies as well. You could swap files with PCs. That was really easy to do on there as well. And today, you know, really straightforward architecture. There's no custom chips in there, which makes it, you know, a lot easier for developers to make games for and ports from the PC. Very easy to emulate as well. So I think, yeah, I mean, especially the music side of it as well. We know that, you know, Aphex Twin to Fatboy Slim, pretty much anyone that made dance music back in the 90s, many of which we've had on this podcast, use the Atari ST. Those MIDI ports were a real game changer. So, yeah, as much as we might poke a bit of fun at it because we are Amiga fanboys, I think it is worth it. If you haven't looked at the ST before, maybe fire up an emulator this weekend and have a little look at some bits of library. Check out some of the demos on it as well. You might just be impressed. So, happy 40th birthday to the Atari ST. Now, this looks awesome. They're calling this, this feels like Ocarina of Time meets Aladdin. This is a new demo called Azaran Islands of the Djinn.
This does look cool. It looks, the gameplay style of it is incredibly similar to Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask. Right down to kind of like the display hood, you know, even like the buttons at the top where you put your items in kind of look like the N64 buttons. Obviously, this is a demo for PC at the moment. Graphically, kind of similar to Zelda, Ocarina of Time, but it also kind of looks like, Ravi might agree with me here. You remember the PlayStation that you could develop on the Net Eurosa?
Terra Incognita, that one.
Yeah, it looks like the games that would
Net
come
Euros,
out.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks like the games that would come out on that, which isn't a bad thing. It just reminds me.
And also like Skies of Arcadia as well a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, it does actually.
Just the style of it. I think it's the kind of emptiness of it, but that's deliberately done.
Yes.
You know, it's really nostalgic in that sense that you've got like a few textures and everything's really smooth as well, because obviously it's running on a PC on a new machine. So it's like you can see that it's been deliberately done.
Yeah,
in that way, and some of the shading's been done that way, and the blockiness is there for a reason.
Yeah, definitely.
And aesthetically, it's really nice. It's by a guy called Benji.
Yeah,
he's a game dev from Wales, and he's talking about releasing this demo and how important it's actually been on his Twitter at the moment. And he's saying, you know, before it was impossible to validate his game design without anybody actually playing it.
Mm.
So now he's got the demo out there. He's getting loads of feedback from people.
Yeah.
And that's really going to help when he does the final release. And,
Yeah, you know,
does a lot of extra levels.
Yeah. No, I really like the look of it. It's kind of like Zelda meets Aladdin, and like you just threw in there, Skies of Arcadia. I like that reference.
Yeah,
as well.
Bit Prince of Persia 3D as well.
Yeah, yeah, definitely, in terms of the aesthetic of it. In terms of gameplay, I said it already, Ocarina of Time, you've got the Z targeting on there. So like, obviously it's not an N64 game, so you don't press Z, but you've got the targeting system on there, which locks you onto the enemy. And then you can, you know, use your bow and arrow, or use your scimitar sword, which looks really cool with puzzles, etc. Right down to having, you know, your life bar is hearts. You know, he's not mentioned Zelda anywhere, but this guy's got to be a big Zelda fan, 100%.
Even the dialogue when you're talking to other characters, that is straight out of Zelda, isn't it? The way that looks and works.
Yeah,
so I'm looking at the Steam page now. You can wishlist it and download that playable demo from Steam and his itch page as well. And I mean, there's currently 24 reviews on there. Everyone's saying looks really promising.
He's also saying Final Fantasy VII was an inspiration as well. Yeah.
So it looks awesome if you're a big fan of that kind of late 90s aesthetic. It looks really atmospheric as well from the screenshots I've seen and the short videos. So absolutely want to keep an eye on another demo that's worth a quick play. Now, this is quite exciting. Imagine this one piqued your interest a bit, Joe, being our resident light gun game fan. This is Konami, who is apparently stealthily rolling out a new Contra light gun game across a few arcades in America. This has been spotted.
So, obviously, Konami haven't really paid a lot of attention to their IPs over the years, kind of releasing or giving the rights to other companies. You know, we've got a Metal Gear Solid 3 remake coming out at some point this year. There was a Contra game the back end of last year, which was apparently actually really good, but I haven't played it. But this is Contra Burst, which, you know, it's saying it's a new arcade game. And there's a short video here, you know, on a YouTube page, giving like the first look of it. It's a ticketed machine. So you know how you go into these modern arcades now and you play a game, you know, whatever it could be, you know, throwing balls at the clowns and stuff like that. And you swipe
across
a card.
Crossy road.
Yeah, crossy road and stuff like that. You swipe a card and you get tickets onto the card. You don't actually physically get tickets out anymore. It's one of them games.
To be fair, I quite like the Galaga one and Space Invaders.
Don't get me wrong, I enjoy them. My only problem with them is, you know, you put £10 on your card, each goes a pound or whatever, £2, and the games last like 20 seconds.
You just haven't got the skills, Joe. Yeah. You're rinsing through your...
Maybe.
It's true.
Maybe it's that.
Sounds like a challenge.
Maybe it's that. But the game is two-player, light gun shooting the screen, but it's the fixed kind of like cannons, you know, like where it's like a turret, you know, with like triggers on the top and you shoot the screen. But what is interesting about it is on the screen, it isn't like a first-person typical, you know, light gun kind of like game, is you actually have the Contra characters. It still looks like Contra from the side. You know, that kind of like, it's not 2D, but, you know, it's the 2D platformer perspective. And they're walking along, and where you shoot is where the characters shoot. So you kind of have to protect, it's kind of like protecting them, it looks like to me, but you are actually playing as those characters, but you shoot the screen with your guns. So I thought that was quite a cool concept. And then you obviously score points and you get tickets. So, you know, I imagine these are going to be popping up everywhere soon, but I'm just... not convinced that it's like, oh my god, look at this, it's an old school kind of like, you know, cabinet. I don't think that is what it is at all. I just think it's, you know, one of these ticket cabinets.
Yeah,
you know.
You're right, and it is weird. It's got like two screens on it as well, so you've got your main screen that you're fighting at, and then underneath you've got an island map, which seems a bit useless to me. Maybe you could have like achievements and stuff going on the bottom, but it looks like a huge Nintendo DS kind of style setup with the two screens.
Yeah, it does a little bit actually, and graphically it looks a bit Nintendo DS-y as well. You know, it's cool to see, but Konami haven't recognized it anywhere on like their social media or on their website or anything like that. I definitely think it's being developed by a third party company that make these ticketed machines.
Right.
You know, which are fun. I went in one the other night on a date night with my missus, you know, and we had fun. We played like some zombie thing where you won tickets and stuff, but we literally won like, you know, got a bag of sweets.
Yeah, I was doing like, oh, I've got 500,000 tickets. And yeah, you can get a little, like some bubbles that you blow or something. Yeah. Like, oh, I was going to win like a PlayStation 5 or something.
But it's also, I'm so torn. Like, it's cool because it's Contra. Like...
Yeah. Just see a new Contra game out there.
Yeah.
I suppose it's pretty cool. So, I mean, as you said, they haven't gone really big on this. You know, they're not marketing it. And it looks like it's kind of just popped up at a few of these Round 1 USA venues across America, which are arcades. So, yeah, there's like two or three of them out there by the looks of it. So it looks like they might just be testing it in a few markets.
Yeah.
See how popular it is. So, yeah, I mean, as you said, they could end up popping up everywhere if it does well. So interesting to see. We'll let you know more if we ever get around to playing it. So if you want to check that out, and of course, all the rest of the stories, you don't have to Google around. I save you the job every week by putting them in the show notes. Just check your podcast app, or you can click through directly from our website at theretrohour.com. Right, for our patrons, we've got a couple of extra new stories on the way for you because we chopped the adverts out. If you want to join our patrons community, all the details are at theretrohour.com, and the brilliant hangout that we had over the weekend as well. Great to see a few new faces there. We've got a brand new episode of our patrons only Gold Members and Above podcast coming out in the next couple of weeks as well, called The Retro Hour After Hours. Loads of perks as well for being a patron. So if you'd like to support us on there, all the details are at theretrohour.com. Right, then, before we hop into our chat this week, Chronicles of Riddick, lots more as well, with our guest Cos Lazarus. He's on the way in just a minute. Let's take a second to give a huge thank you to our wonderful sponsor. It's our mates at Shopify. Now, Shopify, just incredible. We've talked about Shopify quite a lot on this podcast. We are big fans of it. Again, it's one of those services that we actually used before they sponsored the podcast. You know, we only take sponsors onto the show that we really believe in. And the great thing about Shopify is that it's perfect if you're at that stage where maybe you're starting something new. So at the moment, it feels like, you know, everyone I know is starting some kind of side hustle, or maybe you're setting up a business for yourself. It can feel a bit overwhelming, you know, all the stuff you've got to do at the start of your company. But the one thing that's really going to help you out is having a tool that not only simplifies everything, but also feels like having an expert to guide you through all of that and really let you focus on the thing you enjoy, which of course is making your product or running your business. And for millions of businesses, that tool is Shopify. Now, they are the commerce platform behind millions of businesses all around the world. Huge companies like Mattel and Gymshark use them, but also brands that are just getting started as well. We've been selling our books on Shopify. Now, if you remember the Retro Hour book that we did a couple of years ago, we've still got a few copies of that, actually. So if you go to our website and buy one, that will be powered by Shopify. And that's something that we set up, and it was really straightforward. It's basically, when you log in, it gives you basically a design studio, doesn't it, Ravi, with all of these incredible templates that are just point and click and drag and drop.
Yeah, it's like you can go really complex, or you can just do it simply, easy and quick. You know, there's some great templates in there, and you can get your store up and going. And also, what I like is they work as a desktop, and then they also work as a mobile site as well. So, you know, you can get customers using all the different types of devices, but then you can also use a point of sale system as well. So you can actually have one, a physically present kind of store, and you know, you've got your little market going on, you've got your point of sale unit, you can have your inventory on there as well, you know what's in stock, and then do payments really quick as well. You know, we've had it set up before with our phone, and it's just been fantastic.
Yeah, we've used it at events before to sell books. So yeah, really, really takes all the headache out of doing all of that. And they also have AI tools in there as well. Obviously, everyone's got AI these days, but Shopify's are really good. Help you with your product descriptions, your page headlines, even enhance your photography as well. So your images really pop on your Shopify store. And they also got, it's basically like having a marketing team as well, and get you selling across all your social media marketplaces. So basically, wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling, Shopify is there. Think of them as a all-in-one commerce expert with world-class expertise, with everything from managing inventory to international shipping, processing returns, lots more as well. So if you sell anything at all, you're ready for Shopify. So turn your big business idea into, thanks to our friends at Shopify, by your side. So why don't you give it a go? No brainer, because we've got it for just £1 a month or $1 a month. You can give this a try for. Head to this link, they'll know that we sent you, helps out the podcast, shopify.co.uk/retrohour, shopify.co.uk/retrohour, and try out Shopify for just £1 a month and get ready to hear a lot more of this. All right, well, thank you for checking out the news this week. We'll have more for you on next Friday's podcast. And next, going inside the world of Chronicles of Riddick, hearing about his incredible new game, Vice Undercover, stories from some incredible studios like Bit Studios back in the day, and lots more as well. Cos Lazarus is our guest. He's next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're with the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time for our favourite bit of the show when we welcome on this week's very special guest. Now, today we're going to be joined by someone who is a 33-year veteran of the video games industry. Worked at some incredible places as well. Worked at Bit Studios, involved in the fantastic Chronicles of Riddick games as well, and currently is working on a retro-inspired, set in the 80s, point-and-click adventure game, which, if you're a regular listener, you know that I absolutely love point-and-click adventure games, so I can't wait to hear a bit more about that, and his history in the industry as well. Let's welcome on our guest this week, Cos Lazarus. How are you, Cos?
Hi, good. Very happy to be here.
Yeah, appreciate you taking some time to hopefully do some reminiscing with us. As we said, you know, 33 years in the industry, you've seen a lot of change over that time, I imagine. But I'm always interested in kind of our guest's history, you know, taking it right back to the beginning, because we'll get into your rather unusual route into the industry in just a bit. But I mean, before that, were you into video games as a kid? I mean, what's kind of your earliest memory of them?
I had a Benetone machine. So, you know, back when it was the fake Pong, essentially. I think, you know, every kid my age was into, you know, it was the cusp of the beginnings of the industry. So yeah, I was totally into it. And then I got really into comics. So comic books became my real passion. And that's kind of the direction I was going in. And I was certain I was either going to be in the comic book industry or I was going to be an art forger. So those were my two options. But yeah, I grew up gaming, arcade machines. You know, that was really the thing that we would go out and do as, you know, as a bunch of mates, really.
Which arcade machines always drew you straight to them? Was there any that you made a beeline for in the arcade?
Galaxian, like all Centipede, just all the original stuff. And then the other thing that was huge when I was growing up was the little handheld Asteroids type little portable gaming machines. And so yeah, it was really old school. And then obviously the NES came out, changed everything. But by that point, I think I was starting to get to that age where, yeah, I was kind of moving away from games. And like I said, I was passionate about comics, and that's all I would do. I would just draw comic books and sit on that path. And yeah, that was my direction.
Yeah. I was going to say, I heard and read that you were a big comic book collector. And as you just said, you know, originally that was going to be the career path. And I love the story. I've read the story about how you get into the games industry with Bit Studios, but that was completely by accident. So what's the story there? You really want to get into, you know, illustration, etc., comic book career, and then you land yourself in the gaming industry. What's the story there?
I was drawing from an early age, and I had done a few bits through school for the BBC, just like really small little creative things. And then I was, you know, building up this portfolio. So I was about 14 at this point, and my family member used to work in a grocery store. And he said to me, look, you know, there's this comic book guy that comes in, and I was telling him about you, and, you know, he said, sure, he would look at your stuff. So I gave all of the stuff that I'd developed up until that point, but it was literally like in two pieces of cardboard. Mm. I had no portfolio or anything, and I sort of just handed it. I was 14. So I'd handed this to my relative. And then I got this response from John Bolton. So I don't know if you know who John Bolton is, but a really huge painter in the comic book, in a cover artist in the industry, Hellraiser, and did a lot of work with Clive Barker, and I mean, tons of stuff. And his message was, look, this is really fantastic. I want to meet up with you at UCAC, so the UK comic convention, buy a portfolio. So I did meet up with him there, and he introduced me to a lot of people. I ended up getting an agent and also joining David Lloyd's class, the guy that did V for Vendetta. And I was being trained to be taken into 2000 AD and UK Marvel. So 2000 AD was my dream. That was I wanted to be.
Well, you went more into like the horror and the edgier kind of stuff and sci-fi, just with you mentioning you know, Clive Barker and Hellraiser and stuff there, and then 2000 AD.
No, I was into the British stuff, which was less superhero.
But
much more sort of, well, literally everything but superheroes. So I did, you know, I was taken in there. They, you know, they were training me up. They gave me some already published scripts as test runs. And I was on the way, and then I found out how much I paid. And it was like, oh, this is actually quite a difficult industry to make money in. And it's really hard work. And I shared an agent with a guy called John Hicklinton. Rest in peace. I mean, really fantastic guy. And he ended up doing Nemesis, the Warlock, at 2000 AD. And later on, you know, we'll fast forward, but when I eventually did get into the game industry, I ended up like bringing him in because, you know, he was working full time and also working in our price because it just wasn't, it just needed to supplement an income. But this is a long time ago. I mean, things have changed and, you know, there's a much broader sort of career in comics back then in England, especially where it's much more sort of local. It was challenging, and I'm not very fast. That's the other thing. So I really wanted to do this, but you know, I wasn't gonna be able to compete with some of these other kids that were just knocking out a page every other day.
Yeah.
So I ended up deciding to go to art school, and I was doing my graphic design course. And that's kind of, yeah, how I accidentally fell into the game industry. So, I can tell you that story.
Yeah, it's a great story.
Yeah, I was inadvertent. So my best friend, who also wanted to be in comics, we ended up doing the same course at the same university. We were at Middlesex at the time. And sort of halfway through, actually, we had the last year to go, and it was coming up to the summer. And there was a guy that was at the university whose job was to find placements for graduates, but he also did summer placements for, second years. And so we went to him and said, look, we want to find a summer piece at anywhere exotic. So it was like Madrid, Milan, New York, because he said he had international contacts. And also back then, I don't know if you guys are young, but there was a big rise in commercials as like mini films, especially out of the UK. So it was super cool for us. He ended up getting a interview for my friend and told him to tell me about it in Cricklewood in London, which back then was not the most exotic place in London either. So my friend had arranged an interview. And it turned out it was an interview for a storyboard artist at this company, this gaming company. And I was unaware, but it turned out that he didn't go to the interview that day. Something had come up and he couldn't make it, and he had called them and rescheduled this. So the day he had rescheduled, he called me and he said, look, I'm going to this interview, and explained what it was and said, do you want to come for the ride? So I was like, yeah, of course. So I went out and met with him, and he was, he was telling me all about it, and we were standing waiting for the bus. And then we sort of realized how long it would take to get from where we were to this interview by public transport. It meant we'd have to go all the way into town and then come all the way back on ourselves with an overground train. And it was going to be about an hour and 20 minutes. So my friend was like, I don't know if I can do this every day for the summer. So yeah, I don't think I'm going to go, but if you want to go instead, that would be cool, which is absurd. I mean,
it takes some guts to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I jumped at it. So I ran home. I only lived, close to him. I got my portfolio and I came back and we went, and he came. So I turned up and it was Bit Studios, the very early days of Bit Studios. And he sat outside waiting for me, and I went upstairs and the receptionist greeted me with my friend's name. And I said, no, actually, I'm really sorry, but he couldn't make it because he had some emergency, but he didn't want to waste your time, because he had already canceled before. So he sent me in his place. And we thought that was a fine thing. I mean, thinking back on it.
The naivety
like,
of
well,
youth.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, well, of course, you send somebody else, just, we're doing you a favor, not wasting your time. They were really perturbed. She didn't know what to do. I think if they had security, they would have asked me to, they would have called them. but she did go in and speak to the owner of the company, a guy called Fukutan. And he came out and he was like, look, this is really unorthodox, but you're here. So, and they really needed a storyboard artist because they were starting a couple of new projects. So he interviewed me, and I think it was about 20 or 30 minutes. He offered me the job. He really liked, because I'd showed, I had this whole comic book portfolio. Mm. So it was very storyboard. And then he's shown me around. He offered me the job, and then he showed me around the studio, and this was around lunchtime. So a lot of people were leaving, the studio to go out to lunch, and he's like, well, we're about to start this Terminator 2 game, and we're working on Spider-Man, and they were doing an R-Type port at the time. They were in early conversations. He didn't mention it, but I saw some illustrations, or some assets I should say, about Aliens. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. I've got this job, and I'm gonna actually draw Spider-Man in an official capacity.
I heard you got to see the original scripts and storyboards for Terminator 2 as well.
Yeah, so it was on my first day, that was the first thing they handed me was the box of the storyboards of this movie that had come out the year before that changed everything. I mean, it's like, wow. And that, I'm going to geek out a little bit. The freeway scene in Terminator 2, the chase scene.
Yeah.
To see that storyboarded out and it's identical. Like, wow. The storyboard artists on that movie were incredible. I think actually a lot of it was
James Cameron,
right?
Yeah, he did a lot of himself, didn't he? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, but I didn't get to see that until my first day. But I left. The interview was over. I walked out. My friend was waiting for me. And this plays out a bit later in the story. Everyone that had gone to lunch, my friend was literally sitting outside the offices. So everyone that had gone to lunch has walked past him, you know, and he's sitting on the wall there. So I went and got him and he's like, okay, let's go. So as we're walking, I said, yeah, I got the job. It's amazing. They're working on Spider-Man and they're working on Terminator and they're doing this and R-Type. And my friend was a huge, huge gamer at this point, but he knew the games and he knew the boxes, but he didn't know the structure of the industry as nearly like, but he's like, but I've never heard of Bit Studios. You know, I know Acclaim and I know EA and I know, you know, all of these publishers.
Mm.
And I said, yeah, they were telling me, you know, he was explaining there's publishers and they work for them and they're working for this Acclaim company. And he was like, oh, shoot. Okay. So we went to lunch and we're chatting and he's getting more and more sort of like, oh no, what have I done? So he's like, do you think I should call him? And we had there was no cell phones at this point. And he's like, I should call and sort of just, you know, apologize for not turning up. And I said, yeah. So we were in a pub actually having lunch and there was a payphone and he called and, you know, and he was like, look, you know, hope you like my friend. And Fu was like, yeah, he was great. We offered him the job. And then my friend asked to come for an interview. And he said, you know, he's like, look, there was one spot.
Yeah.
And he's like, but no, that's okay. You know, there's only one job. And he's like, it's okay. I will just come and work for free. And I think Fu was so, again, taken back. He agreed. He was like, okay, come for an interview. But just, you know, thinking back on it with my friend, it's like, you know, you have an interview, you cancel it, you make another interview, you don't turn up, you don't tell them you're not turning up, you just send somebody else. Then you call up and say, I will come and work for you for nothing. It's all good. It was nuts.
Must have blown the mind.
It did. And he's really good. He was a really good comic artist as well. And thankfully, they did hire him, not for free, but they didn't. We weren't on equal pay to begin with because of this situation. I mean, they all righted itself later on, but
I mean, yeah, it is a very unusual situation. And speaking of, because I mean, I've been researching about kind of your early days there. So summer 1992, you know, you're working there as a storyboard artist, at Brit Studios as well. You're working on Spider-Man, which obviously a huge franchise. I heard, speaking of like slightly unorthodox things, you actually used to drink wine at your desk to help you with the artistic.
Yeah, that goes back to that meeting with John Bolton at UKAC, actually. And again, for geeky comic fans, this was the UK comic convention that Alan Moore had blown up at that point. And he was harassed for, you know, by all these fans at that event. And there was a bunch of big names there. There was Ben Fabry and Mike McMahon and, you know, John and David Lloyd, all of these huge people. And he introduced me to a lot of them. One of them was Mike McMahon that was working on Slain for 2000 AD. And one of the criticisms I got from, there were kind of two camps that would look at my artwork. One was really into the detail and the other was, you're way over detailing your stuff. And Mike McMahon was in the, you're over detailing the camp. So he's like, look, what you want to do is like, what I do at least is I sit down with my paintbrush, my ink, a bottle of whiskey and, you know, and just let it flow. And as a 14-year-old kid, that kind of stuck with me. I didn't go off and drink whiskey and ink, but it stuck with me. And so the first day I started, I was like, okay, so I'm now officially drawing for, you know, comic art, even though it's for a game. So I came to work with a bottle of wine on my first day and just drew and drank wine. And this went on for a couple of weeks. I was drinking probably a bottle to two bottles a day. Oh. Yeah, there was a few of silliness. But nobody said anything. I mean, a few people said, oh, yeah, that's cool, or whatever it was. But nobody said, look, you can't drink at work. But yeah, this was my first real job. So I didn't really occur to me. You know, I had started with Spider-Man, but it was a Spider-Man Game Boy game. So, you know, the illustrations I was doing, I mean, it really was storyboarding for the game design on this. But I was just like, okay, the very first thing I did was a huge airbrush painting of Spider-Man fighting the Hobgoblin, which, you know, has, how is that useful for a game, you know, a Game Boy game? But it was Spider-Man 3 Invasion of the Spider Slayers was the game. So about a week in, I got called into a meeting, and it was, my first official meeting. There was a team that they were creating a pitch for a game based on rollerblades, and who asked me to join and listen in. And I had drunk quite a bit of the wine at this point. So everything was a little bit woozy, and it was my first meeting. And, you know, and there was this team of, like, you know, professional people. Because I still, you know, I felt like a bit of an imposter syndrome at this point. So I sat down and the room started spinning. And to avoid anyone talking to me or asking me questions, especially my boss, as they were talking, I was just furiously drawing. And I've got to say, the thing that Mike McMahon said is, it's true. You know, if you don't recommend this, but yeah, if you are in this really loose sort of frame of mind, it does float. And I was just creating characters, and they were coming up with game design ideas and pitching around. And so I was listening to what they were doing. So I was coming up with sort of obstacles and enemies. And yeah, but at the end of this meeting, everyone was like really impressed because I had produced this huge volume of work within this meeting. But the only reason I was doing this is just to avoid anyone speaking to me.
How slurry you would have been. Yeah,
or even like cohesively answering something. But it kind of changed everything because I'd started as this storyboard artist, and it was the company structure was really loose. It wasn't really teams, and it wasn't really departments. It was kind of really quite loose. People were like, yeah, I mean, the only way I can describe it was like very, very unstructured. And about a week or so later, well, since that meeting, actually, it became, look, are you interested in also design? And yeah, I think that meeting literally changed the path of my career, I think. So it went from being the storyboard artist on this Game Boy game to, you know, to also having game design input.
Well, speaking of which, actually, one game I'm quite interested to hear a bit more about is, because you were credited with concept and design on the Super Nintendo and Game Gear versions of Last Action Hero.
Yeah.
So what was kind of your initial vision there? Because obviously it's a bit of a meta action film.
Right. So this is the very first, that is literally the first game that I had full, that was my first actual game. You know, so I provided some extra input on the Game Boy Spider-Man, and I was doing some stuff for the Terminator thing, and then they got this deal for Last Action Hero. And I think, you know, naivety has served me very well in my career. So the idea that, you know, not really understanding that I can't do it. So I was like, yeah, sure, I'm going to design this game. I'd never designed a game. And I read the script. They sent the script over. And actually, the game design is one of my proudest moments. I really love the idea that we had for this game. So I don't know if you remember the movie, but you know, Schwarzenegger goes in and out the silver screen. So the idea of the game was, you know, it was Arnold Schwarzenegger in the real world, and it was all sort of action and, you know, side scroller beat 'em up and gunplay. And there was lots of different sort of weaponry all the way through to this, you know, the helicopter that you had to take down with rockets and all sorts of stuff. And then when you go into the silver screen, the player's character completely changed to this caricature, a cartoon-sized version. And when we sent the design to Sony ImageSoft, they, I think I might have the letter, the response that they came back with, that they, it was one of the most innovative game designs that they'd had on any of their projects, and this and that and the other. And I can't remember all the details of the stuff that we were coming out with, but because I hadn't done it, you know, I think it was, you know, I had a little bit more abstract thought.
You weren't thinking of like any sort of like limitations or anything. You were like, this is my idea, I'm just going to roll with it. Like,
yeah. And the team, the little team that they gave me, were the programmers were, you know, who were the gods of this, you know, the restrictions were down to them. So, and I was coming up, can we do this and can we do that? And they were just like, oh yeah, well, we can, you know, we can't do this, but we can maybe sort of do this version. And then, you know, I'll cut to the end. It's the probably the worst reviewed game I've ever worked on, because what ended up happening, it was actually, you know, not a nice event, clearly, but there was an attack on the first attack on the World Trade Center. And there was a huge, I don't know how many feet it was, sort of inflatable of Schwarzenegger holding a grenade in one hand and a gun in the other, right near there to advertise Last Action Hero. Or one of his other movies. I can't remember what it was, actually. But we then, you know, we were about 5-6 months into development of the game. And then they came back and they said, you cannot have any weapons. You can't have him. I mean, they literally took everything out of the game. So, and we couldn't scrap it because you know, it cost a lot of money back then. You know, and the margins were very small for developers. So we stripped all the weapons out, and it was like this, you just walk in and punch in things. I mean, I think there was one level we even had like that helicopter firing rockets, and you punch the rockets back at the helicopter.
I've played it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's terrible. Yeah, the end result was my first huge lesson in the problems of doing IP-based games. And I've done a lot of IP-based games since then. But yeah, that was the first big one. It did lead to Sony ImageSoft being impressed that we managed to finish it and, you know, and get it out still in time, that they ended up giving bits a couple other, two more projects.
Yeah.
But yeah, the end result was terrible.
You also worked on another IP, the Itchy and Scratchy game, and that game had to match the turn of The Simpsons. What was that process like? You know, was, you know, 20th Century Fox involved or anything? Was that through Sony, or, you know, is that a completely different story there? Or
actually didn't have any interaction with Fox. Obviously, okay. It was owned by them. Everything went through Acclaim. So right. This was the first Acclaim game that I was working on. And then soon after starting that game, I was also given Justice League. I loved working on the Itchy and Scratchy game. And soon on my social media, I'm going to post all of the original artwork that we did.
Oh, nice.
But it's like, you know, it's tons of animation storyboards of all of the actions. And again, the game was, if for people that don't know Itchy and Scratchy, it's sort of a hyper-violent Tom and Jerry, essentially.
Yeah.
It was, you know, multiple levels of going through different environments. And then the big deal was designing these sort of huge trap bosses at the, at the end. Another early lesson, I think it was okay. The end result was not how I envisioned the game. And I think my focus again was much more about the sort of the animation and getting, you know, the tone of these characters across, and, you know, trying to sort of do an extension of the show than than the pure joy of the gameplay.
Did they give you much parameters yet to work with things? We've talked to people that worked on Simpsons games before, and apparently like Matt Groening's team said, you know, you can do this with this character, you can't do that. The eyes have got to look a certain way, the hairstyle, you know, very, very strict about it all.
No. Oh. I created characters for that game that made it into the game. There were like these little versions of Scratchy called the Chumleys, and they went in. All the feedback that we were getting it from Acclaim, and I don't know, again, back then, I didn't really know the process of how IP-based games work. When I sort of have been on the other side of the fence on it, I'm stunned at how much leeway we actually had on that game. And, you know, some of the stuff that we added in, there was literally everything. You know, I think we definitely had events and characters and objects and stuff that were not in the show. And I have been around the development of Simpsons games when I was working at Fox, and seeing how much control on this, particularly that franchise, you know, after the fact, it's really, yeah, it was really not a lot of oversight. And actually the next project I did was the same kind of thing, the same sort of lack of attention. So the next game I got was actually the Justice League game.
Yeah.
And I inadvertently blew up that deal accidentally, which led to what actually was my next game, which was Wolverine.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. So what's the story there? I was interested because you mentioned at the start how, obviously, you know, with comic books, you were into 2000 AD, you weren't into superheroes. And all of a sudden, a few years down the line, you've worked on Spider-Man, you've worked a little bit on Justice League, you then were working on Wolverine. Like, you're going on these huge, like, iconic superheroes. Yeah. Like, I know Wolverine's a little bit different, he's a little bit more edgy and stuff like that. So I was wondering what the story was there and how that felt kind of working on these games.
I was a big superhero comic fan. So right. I was collecting Spider-Man from a really early age. I had, you know, a complete run from 1 to, wow. to 300. I mean, obviously not 300 at that point, but yeah, I was collecting Fantastic Four and Avengers and Silver Surfer and Hulk. And
Yeah.
But it never, you know, when I was saying about 2000 AD, it's like it never occurred to me that kid in London was a kid in England, you know, at that point in time was gonna work in American comic books. You know, this was sort of too out of reach.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, then ending up working on, you know, I know it's not on the comics, but in an official capacity on those IPs was bananas for me. It was really hard to comprehend, actually. And again, led to the naivety that led to the Justice League game being cancelled. So we'd got this game, we had just started, and I think the publisher was Sunsoft, and it was summer, the next summer.
Yeah.
And because I'd been working on Itch and Scratchy, and I'd been working with Acclaim, the producer I was working on became quite friendly with him, and he said, "Well, you should come to New York for vacation." So I did. So I went to New York, and again, first time in America. Because I was going, the person I was speaking to at DC Comics in the very early stages of this game was not a video game guy. He was a guy, I guess, that they had assigned at DC to talk to, you know, the company that's making the game as the point person, not an oversight guy. I think it was just, you know, he was sort of my level, but for DC. And I let him know that I was coming, and he was like, "Oh, well, we should do lunch and meet up." And, you know, because at that point we'd exchanged faxes. This was like a very slow conversation. So I met up with him for lunch, and we had lunch, and then he's like, "Do you want to come back to DC, you know, to the offices, and I'll show you around?" And I was like, "Yeah." So they're showing me around. He's walking me around, and there was a big event that they were doing with one of their biggest superheroes, and he showed me the rooms that they were working on, and I guess I wasn't supposed to see any of that. I mean, I didn't really realize what was happening. I was just like in awe. And then he took me to the vault and showed me, you know, he was showing me all of the early issues of stuff. And as we're walking, he introduced me to the president. I mean, it was nuts. You know, I just stuck my head in and said hello, but we were walking past and he was saying, "This is the guy that's doing the Justice League game." And we walked past an office and it was this VP and he introduced me as the guy, you know, from the company that's doing the game. And she's like, "Oh, fantastic. We should set up a meeting." And I didn't know what to do. So I was just like, "Yeah, okay, whatever you want, you know, I'm on vacation, but I'll work." And she thought that I was from Sunsoft. So she called Sunsoft and said, "Right, we're setting up this meeting. Your guy's here." And they're like, "What guy?" And "Yeah, your guy's here and he wants to do a meeting with everybody about Justice League and, you know, to kick off the design stuff." And they're like, "We have never heard of this guy." I mean, Sunsoft had hired Bits, yeah, or they would, you know, but I wasn't there officially doing a meeting. I was just walking around with some guy and, you know, and just saying yes to whatever anyone said to me. Like, "Do you want to do a meeting?" "Sure." So yeah, that turned into a massive disaster. And Sunsoft ended up calling the agent for Bits and saying, "I don't know who you guys think you are, but turning up at DC Comics and trying to start a meeting without us or not informing us." And I'm on the phone to food. I was terrified. Well, I called immediately. As soon as I left, I called. I couldn't get hold of Fu. I got hold of the next person in charge. Said, "This and this has happened. But throw me under the bus. I will, you know, it was just say I had nothing, you know, you had nothing to do with it. And I, you know, I totally understand that I'm fired." And I eventually did get, again, no cell phones or email. So, you know, I had to get back to the hotel and I had to get coins to use the phone box to try and get hold of Fu internationally. And anyway, it did get cancelled. I did explain what happened. They sort of realized it was not the way it had been described. But yeah, they lost that project. About a week later, they got this new startup. There was this new group guy. Toy Biz had acquired Marvel, Avi Arad, and they kickstarted the first video game based on a Marvel character at that point with this new venture. And that's obviously, I don't know if you know Avi Arad, but that's the catalyst of what became the Avengers movies. So they handed me Wolverine, and that was an amazing experience working on that. That was my first full, real, here's my team, designed everything. I did loads and loads of artwork. I filmed myself on a video camera doing all of the actions and we ended up rotoscoping a bunch of stuff. A lot of the actions, I pulled a team together. I hired new people. And I worked on that game 7 days a week, about 17-hour days for roughly 10 months.
Wow.
To the point where they ended up building showers in in Bits. And we had beds in the second floor.
Oh, wow.
Because I was essentially living at the office.
I definitely want to make sure that we've got time to cover the Riddick games, because, you know, they were huge. Skipping forward a couple of years, I mean, you were brought on as a head of development at Tegan Studios, which Vin Diesel actually founded that company. So how did he get involved with that? And is Vin Diesel much of a gamer, is he?
Gosh, huge gamer. So there wasn't a... So Vin has been gaming since he was a kid, from Dungeons and Dragons onwards. I think he was playing a campaign with his character, the character called Melkor. And actually, if you watch the first XXX movie, he's got his character, his D&D character's name tattooed across his stomach in that movie, in old English type. So yeah, he was a huge gamer, but he had optioned the life rights to this guy. Before he became a huge star, he had optioned the life rights of this guy he had met, a cop in New York, of a story. And he wanted to do a game based on this. So the initial meeting, when I met with him, we had a mutual friend in the industry. So his agent in his agency had a game division, a newly developed game division. It's somebody I had worked with at Warner Brothers. And I actually had seen Pitch Black, and I called my friend and I said, dude, if this guy ever gets into, if you ever rep this guy in games, call me, because this guy's perfect for video games. And then a few years later, he did call me and he was like, I'm going to do a meeting with you, Vin. He's got an idea for a game. And it was, you know, I met up with him. It was supposed to be a 30-minute meeting to discuss this idea. And he was looking for just somebody to design, you know, to do a, you know, a 10-page pitch. And we ended up chatting for like 4 or 5 hours. And from that conversation, Tygon was born. And he's like, well, let's just create this company. Yeah, that's how that started.
That's awesome. Because didn't Vin Diesel, he actually owned the rights to Riddick? Like, I think if I remember rightly, he was in Pitch Black and then they wanted to do a Chronicles of Riddick film. And he said, for me to do the film, I then have the rights to then go do the game, was it, or something like that?
When he set up Tygon, that he just started on the Chronicles movie, and there was discussions about XXX, what was happening after for the sequel of XXX, but he wanted, you know, his vision was these original titles. He wanted to do a game. We wanted to explore at least Melkor, his D&D character, and explore this New York cop story and Hannibal. So he had been reading, not just reading, I mean, he was really a big scholar on Hannibal. And so it was more about original title. And then when Chronicles happened and they wanted to do the game, that was VUG at that point. And I worked with an amazing guy at VUG, the producer of Riddick, who ended up being the producer of Riddick at VUG's end, is a guy called Peter Warnock. And, you know, they pitched a Starbreeze, the developer had done some work on it, and they had sent it to me, and it was incredible. I mean, the technology that they had developed, the lead programmer on that team is a guy called Magnus, who, you know, who went off, and that team just did Indiana Jones recently. But when they showed that, he was, again, I don't think he was really thinking about games based on films that he was doing, but I was like, look, we've got to be involved in this from the beginning, especially, you know, because any project he works on, he's incredibly immersed in the development of that franchise and the characters, and Riddick is obviously something that's extremely close to him. So yeah, we were in, and we worked very closely with all of them and developed a story and oversaw the development alongside Peter and that team. I mean, that game was, I mean, it's almost impossible to make a game. You know, if you sort of sit back and take it apart and see all the parameters, you know, the length of time, the speed of the change of technology whilst you're developing, the resources, you know, and throughout the, you know, the 33 years in the industry, things have changed, you know, dramatically, and the team sizes are getting bigger and bigger. But you know, getting a game completed, especially based on an IP, is almost impossible, but the stars completely aligned on that project. It's my proudest game, I think.
One thing I found quite interesting about that series as well is Riddick, he's not really your classic hero. He's a bit kind of morally grey, you could say. So how did you approach like building gameplay around someone who isn't a stereotypical hero?
Yeah, anti-heroes is my thing. I don't think it's... Wolverine is not that far removed. But there's a lot of really interesting things about Riddick and about the franchise and the ideas in that film that translated very well to gameplay if you had the technology to do the type of things that you needed to have in order to have that kind of gameplay. So obviously the core thing of Riddick is that he's got an eye shine. So he can see in the dark, and Pitch Black was built around that, where the monsters only come out in the dark when it's pitch black. In fact, I don't know if you remember, but Riddick was the first game to be normal mapped, and the only other game that came out, you know, a few months later was Halo, and it was only a small part of Halo was normal mapped. it was such an intensive tech algorithm at that point. The fact that this team had managed to do that, and that led to all of the game design around really enhanced ideas for right, what happens when it's dark. It's also the approach to that entire game was a cinematic one. And one of the big failings of games based on movies is they end up usually quite poor. And the biggest reason for that is because of the time frame that you have to do a game based on something that's a movie that's going to come out in 8-10 months from now.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, a normal development time is a couple of years. So you're doing sort of a truncated thing. But that game, you know, where we all kind of came to it as, look, it's a standalone thing. It's based on an IP, but it should be an extension of the story and add something to the franchise as opposed to a replicating what that script's going to be, which I know it sounds obvious at this point, but it was very novel at that time. And even the opening sequence, you know, where the titles are, you know, the credits are sort of rolling as you are actually interacting with what's going on. And you're controlling Riddick just doing this walk into the prison.
Yeah.
And people screaming at him, and, you know, the camera's turning, you can move the camera around, and then, you know, and then just the credits are rolling. And even that little thing, it's... And I think that's one of the things we brought to the table, you know, that his involvement added that.
And, you know, it's true what you say. I remember the game being really big at the time. And, you know, like you say, at the time, classically, you know, games based on IPs weren't usually very favourable with reviews and stuff like that. But I always remember that game doing a lot, lot better. And obviously the Vin Diesel attachment is really cool because obviously he was huge at the time, you know, probably... I was going to say probably the peak of his career, but obviously then the Fast and Furious films blew up even more. Obviously working with Vin Diesel and obviously having, you know, you kind of said the planets aligned with getting that game out. Was it difficult to get him in the studio to kind of do all the acting and the voice work and stuff like that? Or was it really, was he really, really, really involved and he just like dropped things for it? Or was it quite difficult to get him in?
I think the intention was always about, like, yes, it's everything you need. But but when he's on a movie, you know, that leading up to the first day of shooting, he's becoming the character that he's about to be. And, you know, and when you're talking to him at that point, if you can get to talk to him, is you're talking to that character. So it was challenging to you know, from a scheduling perspective, you know, because the needs of the game and the developers are not necessarily aligned with what's going on with the making of the film. So there were some challenges. But once he's in the studio, he's a really incredible VO artist, actually. And the script that I brought two writers in, a guy called Flynn Dealey and a guy called John Platton. And we worked on the story and the dialogue and the character and the game story. And when we came into, when we eventually were going to do the recording, he came in and we ended up like re-editing or editing down the recording script for that first day, and we were supposed to get everything in that day. We ended up doing like 4 or 5 hours of dialogue changes within 30 minutes of recording. And then it's like, okay, studio's composed. And then we just had to come back like whenever he had the, when we could all align again. But it worked out. It worked out really, really amazingly well. And the other IP that I worked on before Riddick that actually worked really well was Buffy. So I produced Buffy and designed Buffy and ended up, you know, on that set a lot because I was at Fox at the time. And I ended up designing monsters for the show.
For the show, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you did say, 33 years in the industry and you are, still in the industry, still making games as well, and actually making an incredible new title by the looks of it. So we definitely need to talk about this just to wrap things up, because this is something that comes out later this year, and I've been a lifelong fan of point-and-click adventures, going back to the old Sierra and LucasArts games. And you're working on, you're currently co-CEO of a company called Ancient Machine, and you're working on a new 80s-style point-and-click game called Vice Undercover, set in alternate Miami, is that right? Tell us a bit about this game then, and what the background is.
Yeah, so the game is set in 1985, and it's an alternate Miami. And sort of, you know, the question we sort of asked at the beginning is, well, in the 80s, I mean, Pablo Escobar and the cartels of that era were, you know, gigantic. He was one of the, if not the richest man in the world. But what would they all have achieved if they had the technology that we sort of take for granted? If their internet was prevalent and email and, you know, and you watch shows like Narcos and the lengths that they had to go to circumvent, you know, communications being hacked. And so, you know, what if all of that existed at the time? If there was email, there was IM, there was, you know, rudimentary GPS, and, you know, what's that world? And, you know, I was a huge, huge, huge fan of Papers, Please. So, you know, the idea of, you know, what that game did incredibly well is take some, you know, a mundane action, you know, just studying a passport, and make that a central feature of this, you know, long gaming experience. So we're like, okay, what's the next version of that? So the idea of what you think the idea of this game is, I should say, is, so the most important people for cartels and organized crime are early computer users, specialist hackers, essentially. So the biggest cartel in the game is the Dead Kings, or Los Reyes Muertos, and they have a hacking group led by a guy called Kevin Astra that works exclusively for them. They don't know where this guy is. So, you know, they only ever communicate digitally by email or chainmail in our game. And your character ends up discovering where they're based. And it's a high rise office building in Miami. It's a, you know, it's a accountancy office as a front, and they start surveilling them, and they've got a supercomputer, a version of a Cray, essentially, and it's manned 24 hours a day. So there's three of them, and they take 8-hour shifts. They never meet each other in the office. So when one comes in on his shift, the other one's going out the back door, and it's all for security purposes. So they're never sort of in the same location together. But it means that, you know, these 8-hour shifts, that machine is constantly running. And when somebody's on shift, they don't even go to the bathroom, you know, so they're in front of that computer and that's it. And during the surveillance, they see the main guy, Astra, starts leaving for an hour a day, and they follow into this huge mansion in Coral Gables. They've never seen anyone coming in or out of that place. They don't know who's there, why he's going there. But what they do know is that he's going there every day on his shift without telling anyone or his crew members for an hour. So they send, you know, it's an undercover group. They send somebody in disguised as a cleaner for the building, who then goes up to his office, gets on the machine. She's your character, Vida, has a background as a hacker, but works for the police, and she gets on the machine, and you have to hack your way onto the machine to begin with, and then pretends to be Astra and carries on taking contracts from the cartel, but also the police. So you're instant messaging the police there. You're looking to take down the cartel from the inside. So, and then you've got this time pressure of the guys coming back in an hour, and you've got to find out what he's doing and why he's leaving and why, you know, and it's a huge, intricate story, web of parallel stories and offshoots, and super really in depth. But the, you know, about 70% of the game is that you are on this computer. You're looking at a screen that's you know, essentially Windows 3.1.
Although you call it running. Amigo OS, I noticed. That was an Amiga phone, so I imagine that wasn't a coincidence.
It's Amigo, absolutely, because it's, you know, it's a huge South American influence to the entire game. Got some great people involved just off the concept. Tamer Hassan is playing one of the characters. It's been a lot of Guy Ritchie movies, and as England, as you probably know him in Football Factory, and Kimberly Reyes. You know, it was really important for us that all of the characters came from the, you know, originated from the place that their character originates from. So it's an authentic, you know, performance.
Yeah.
But the entire game is a huge bamboozle. You know, there's a huge twist to it. Everything, as you play through this, and I shouldn't say too much, but as you're playing through this game, you think it's this one thing, and it's not. It's everything about the game is layered. Mm. All of the gameplay and why you're doing what you're doing and what's going on. And we did a lot of research on the Miami Drug Wars, which was, you know, of the 80s. So we've pulled a lot of historical fact into the game, or inspired by at least. There are actual real people that existed in the real world that make their way into the game. One of the hackers, for example, in this crew of three is an English guy. He was the first hacker to be prosecuted under the newly formed Computer Act of probably the actual act, but he was the guy that took over our now King's account.
Robert Schifrin or something was his name, wasn't it?
Yeah,
the Prestel Schifrin. Hacker. Yeah.
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 That's cool.
He's in the game and as one of your crew, actually. And then a lot of historical stuff that happened. It's, you know, we've got a version of that in there. But what was really clear is that it was, you know, obviously there's the cops and there's the cartels, and, you know, there's a clear divide on criminality and law enforcement. But there was a lot of murkiness on corruption and who, you know, who the bad guys were and why some of the bad guys are doing what they're doing. Like, there was a lot of people that worked for the cartels that just had no other, you know, no other options. You know, they're living in areas where that's it, that's the industry. Mm. So we try to get all of that in there, but it is a game about paranoia, and nobody is who they seem, and you don't trust anybody.
Again, with a lot of detective work, a lot of twists and turns by the looks of it. And there is actually, you can check out the trailer. There's also a demo you can download as well on Steam. So I'll put a link to that so everyone can give it a try this weekend and wish list it. Any idea on release date yet then? I know it says quarter 2025. Is it kind of imminent?
It is. We're very close. I mean, we actually finished it a while ago, but because we're self-financing, we just felt that we just cannot afford it. Like, literally, you know, because we put our money up on this, we can't afford to get it wrong. So we completed it a year ago. We've spent a while doing a huge polish over the top of it. So I think, you know, we're around 2 months from completion, and then it's just about finding the right slot to bring it out.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can definitely wishlist it and check it out. And what you'll see in the demo though is a very small part of apps that you have access to in the game. Mm-hmm. But you'll definitely get a taste of what it's about.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, I'll link it up in the show notes, as I mentioned. People can check out the demo and wishlist it for when it arrives in a couple of months' time, fingers crossed. Carlos, it's been an absolute pleasure hearing some of your history in the industry. You know, 33 years, you've done some incredible work and continue to do so as well. So best of luck with Vice Undercover, and thanks so much for coming on and being our guest this week.
Oh, my God, it's my pleasure being here. Thank you so much.